Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I'm Mona, and I was married for 30 years and in that relationship for 32, and we didn't find out until our 29th year of marriage that we were a neurodiverse couple. And we have an amazing 25-year-old daughter, and she is thriving and doing great. And I am so excited today to be able to talk to Dr. K, and Dr. K is going to share hopefully a lot about her experience with neurodiverse couples and her knowledge of neurodiversity. But I wanted to give Dr. K an opportunity to kind of introduce herself and tell us a little bit about the work that she does. So welcome, Dr. K.
Well, welcome. And thank you, Mona, for having me on.
It's fantastic. So can you tell me a little bit about Couples Therapy, Inc. and
sure.
The work you and your colleagues do?
Yes, absolutely. My whole name is Dr. Kathy McMahon, and I'm the president of Couples Therapy, Inc. We started really out of a need to connect, to have, for me anyway, to have other couples therapists that I could associate with and connect with. And one of the things that I think was always really important for me, and it's important for me in working with couples, is to be able to have diverse views. And so really from the very beginning, one of the things that I looked for were people who thought differently, people who were from various countries, and so the practice is actually international. We have most of our therapists are in the U.S., across the U.S., but we also have a couple in, a therapist in Vancouver and another in New South Wales, Australia, who spend some time in Ireland as well. So, and I think that's one of the things that's kind of unusual about us is that not only do we have an international team, which is kind of unusual for a psychotherapy practice, but also that we work intensively with couples. So we see couples that fly in and stay for a weekend, and we do a lot of assessment ahead of time, so that we can kind of hit the ground running working with them. And then we have the time over the weekend to really kind of get down to what are some of the fundamental differences between the two of them, to be able to practice social skills if that's what they're needing, and really be able to work with them on a much deeper level than they would be able to get if they just went to a local therapist every week, week after week, for an extended period of time.
I think that is absolutely wonderful. Before we knew we were a neurodiverse couple, that was something that I looked into for my husband and I, because I felt that, you know, going to a session maybe every week might not allow us to go as deep as we needed to, because I knew we were struggling.
Yeah.
So can you share a little bit about how a neurodiverse couple who is interested in maybe participating in one of your weekend therapeutic sessions, what that would look like and what they might get out of that?
Well, I think the first thing that is intimidating, especially to the person who's neurodiverse, is the fact that they fill out a pretty extensive online assessment, and they do that independently. Each person does it privately. And one of the things that I have heard from folks that are neurodiverse is neuroatypical is they'll say, well, you know, this asks me whether it's true or false. You know, it is both true and false. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things that I say to them is, well, if it's 51% true, then put true. If it's 51% false, put false. So sometimes it can be a challenge for those couples to even begin to fill out the assessment because of that kind of black and white thinking, or the thoroughness of them really wanting to say there's more to it than just true false. And that's one of the reasons why there's a lot of narrative that's involved in the assessment as well. But the key piece, I think, is that when they walk in, that couple, I will already know a great deal about them, not just the kinds of questions that any psychotherapist would know, but because I work within the Gottman method, which is a science-based method where John Gottman has been actually physically studying couples over the last 40 years, really, and really not just sort of taking people's word for what they think about their relationship, but literally, like a scientist, putting them into a weekend in an apartment, doing videotaping of them while they're in that apartment. Now, that's not what we're doing. I'm talking about Gottman's research now.
Right, right.
And
right.
Literally having.
So you were sharing a little bit about the way in which Dr. Gottman and his colleagues learned about what works for couples in general. So share a little bit about that experience for couples that were involved in his research.
So I think the most important thing is that Dr. Gottman thought like a scientist. He didn't think like a psychologist.
Right.
And by that, I mean that he, before any of the studies that he conducted, he made a conjecture of the way he thought things would turn out. And one of the reasons I love the way his mind works so much is that he said, I was wrong 60% of the time when I would make a guess about how this study with couples was going to turn out. Now, listen, he said, if I didn't do the research, I would think I was right 100% of the time. So what I really love about, and this I think really works well with neurodiverse couples, is that when I talk about his research findings, I'm not talking about my own personal opinion. And in fact, I say that before I begin. If I have a personal opinion or if I have a clinical opinion based upon the research that I've done in my own private practice, I will tell you that. But otherwise, I am giving you the research. And if you're curious, I can actually pull up the actual study and talk to you about the actual study that I'm referring to. So it provides, I think, an enormous amount of comfort that the couple sitting in front of me can actually technically understand, technically get the reason why I'm proposing each and everything that I'm proposing. And I can explain to them why is this particular way of working or this behavioral change going to be the most constructive for you and for your relationship. So the important thing for my work is that it becomes factual work. It becomes pragmatic work. It becomes a simple dynamic whereby I say, this is the statistics around what happens if you engage in this behavior versus if you engage in that behavior. And amazingly, I think so many people are actually comforted by that, and that they can ask that question. And instead of just hearing from the therapist because I said so, they're actually able to understand in pragmatic terms why that particular intervention is used in the way that it's being used. So it's one of the advantages, I think, of the Gottman method over other approaches, especially working with neurodiverse couples.
I could not agree more with you, because having that research to back up the methods that you're using to help neurodiverse couples get through the challenges they're experiencing can fit really well for both, you know, the non-autistic and the autistic partner, because they can both do further research and find out what the Gottmans and their colleagues did that made them decide that this was going to be the most effective way in which couples could communicate or deal with conflict or repair or what have you. So let's talk a little bit about what you saw in your practice that made you understand that this therapeutic model would work well with neurodiverse couples. What were you seeing as far as couples either that you knew were neurodiverse or you found out later were neurodiverse?
Yeah.
What were some
yeah.
of the things that you saw?
Well, I can tell you that I'm trying to think. I think that I have very few couples who come in and say, we're a neurodiverse couple. I think historically what's happened is when I say to both of them, I think this partner is neurodiverse, inevitably, one of two things happen. Either, this is oftentimes the case with the wife will say, I thought that was the case. Mm. Or in one particular case, I had the husband say to me, yeah, I know. I mean, I told her that. And she looked at him and said, you never told me that. I would remember if you told me that you were on the spectrum. So it's, you know, usually I'm the one to give the official diagnosis. And I have learned over time, initially when I first started doing it, I was very anxious about having to be able to share that news. As time went on, what I recognized is I wasn't giving a diagnosis that they could go to another psychiatrist and they could take an exam and they could be labeled officially that way. What I did instead is talk about a set of collective behaviors that to me said, I will need to interact with you differently than I will with other couples, because the behavior that I'm seeing, most people will mistake as one thing when in fact I know that it's something else. So for example, I would see people where the wife would say, he's so selfish. Mm-hmm. I think he's a narcissist. Yeah. And yet I would sit down with this couple and both the behavior of the wife as well as the behavior of the husband told me that this was not a case of narcissism. And one of the things that I noticed that I think is really, it's not scientific. It's not from the Common Institute. It's from my own clinical experience, which is that the way in which a wife talks about a husband who I then think is neurodiverse tends to be hurt, but also at the same time, a bit empathetic and tender. In other words, there's almost this feeling like he hurts my feelings really badly, but I don't think he means to do it. And that is not the impression that I get for wives who come to me and actually have husbands who are narcissistic. So it's almost that interactional dynamic between the two of them that tells me, wait a minute, this is not, she's saying this because this is the best guess, but it's also in the way in which she's describing emotionally and the way she relates emotionally to him. Something specific that happened just recently with a couple. The woman said, I'm narcissistic. And I said, well, tell me about why you think that's the case. And she went on in elaborate detail, kind of happily telling me why she thought she was narcissistic and informing me of other people who have told her that. And I said, the way in which you're describing the fact that you're narcissistic has no defensiveness to it whatsoever. Mm. In fact, it's kind of like pragmatic. This is what I heard from somebody. And because I feel this and this and this way about myself based upon the feedback I've gotten from other people, then that must be the case. I said, as a result of that, I just really don't think that you are narcissistic. I could be wrong, but I really feel like there's some neurodiversity. And I told her what I tell many, many couples is, it's much more challenging for me to be able to say that conclusively with women than with men, because they've been enculturated a lot more than men have in general being raised as girls. But the feeling that I have and the way in which I work with a couple and even my decision that says to me, this is a neurodiverse couple, has a lot to do with the interactions between both partners and the way in which, you know, they're talking both about their relationship, about the painful incidents in their relationship and that sort of thing.
Wow, that is so important and will be so valuable for both the non-autistic and the autistic partners who are listening to hear, because I hear repeatedly from folks that are just finding out about neurodiversity that they think their partner might be a narcissist or might be bipolar or some other, you know, mental health issue that they think they're struggling with. And they may be struggling with other mental health issues. But I totally agree with you, and I'm kind of going to paraphrase what you said. I think what folks need to be aware of is if you are with a narcissist, they don't care about you. They don't care that they're hurting you. And I know in my relationship, my ex actually called me a narcissist because I was much more assertive than he was. Mm-hmm. But what I realized, if I had looked at him as a narcissist because he was doing things to protect his mental health and his emotional well-being, yeah, he was shutting down.
Yeah.
And I want to talk a little bit about that because I think that that's a struggle that a lot of couples deal with, either before they know they're neurodiverse or when they're first learning and trying to figure it out, even when they've been together for a really long time. There are ways in which the autistic partner might react that might seem selfish or narcissistic or whatever. And I'd like to talk a little bit about meltdowns and shutdowns and even autistic burnout and what that might look like. And based on what you know about, you know, the Gottman method, how that might be addressed by a neurodiverse couple. Because great, it can be seen very differently if you're neurodiverse. Yeah.
It's a great question. And it's probably heart of the issue when we're dealing with relationships and neurodiversity. So Gottman would put it in the frame of turning towards versus turning away. Yeah. And we would think about it in everyday language as how close is too close and how far away is too far away. Mm-hmm. And so typically what you'll see is with a neurodiverse partner, they need more alone time. They need more time where they can recoup and get their energy back by themselves or by doing their activity that's the most reinforcing to them. And very often we see situations in which the neurotypical wife, I'm thinking, is really trying to reach out and connect. And when either their efforts to reach out and connect fall on deaf ears, they're mm-hmm. ignored, which, is one strategy, or the partner attacks them, which Gottman calls turning against,
right.
There is an enormous hurt that comes because right. making a bid for connection is a vulnerable thing to do. And if historically, the best that the neurodiverse person has learned is to snarl at their partner or to snarl at anybody who's bothering them to get them away, that's not going to be very adaptive because that's basically telling their partner, if you want to emotionally connect with me, I am going to attack you. That's mm-hmm. exactly what you don't want to do. And it, not surprisingly, that person who turns towards repeatedly and gets, turned away or turned against as a result, they're going to stop making those overt gestures. Now, the thing that is interesting, which most people are very surprised by, is the notion that when women attempt to connect, even by complaining about the relationship, 80% of the complaints that are lodged in a relationship are lodged by women. Mm-hmm. And women are kind of the keepers of the relationship, right? They look at their relationship, watch, have we connected? Have we been, feeling close and that sort of thing?
Right.
And what I tell men that's very surprising is, you think if your wife stops doing that, that somehow that's a good thing. She must be happy if she's no longer complaining to you about not getting together, not going out with friends, not hanging out together, whatever. But in fact, what she's doing she's moving further and further away mm-hmm. from the emotional connection, from the relationship itself, and she's allowing what Gottman refers to as she's allowing poop in the pipes.
Yeah.
In other words, under every marital house, there's a sewer system. And you cannot be in a relationship without poop being in that relationship in one way or another. And one of the ways you flush the toilet to move that poop out is by complaining. So literally, when a wife begins to distance herself and make explanations for why she's not complaining anymore, well, he's not going to listen to me. He ignores me anyway. There's no point in talking. I could might as well talk to a wall. All of those explanations that she's now disconnecting from, and she starts to connect with other people instead of her partner, what we see then is that's the beginning of what Gottman calls a cascade of emotional isolation, disconnection, and alienation. So,
Dr. K, we were talking about the way in which a neurodivergent partner may see their partner stepping away and stopping the nagging or the complaining or even the screaming as a good thing. But that's not actually a good thing in a healthy relationship. So can you talk a little bit about that? I know we were on a roll and we got disconnected, so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the important thing is we're requiring both people to develop greater social skills, right? Mm-hmm. We're requiring both the neurotypical partner to learn how to be able to say in a really nice way, hey, I was trying to connect with you. And when you said you were too busy, it hurt my feelings. Can we figure out another time to connect so that I don't feel hurt like we're not relating to one another? And then for the neurodiverse person to hear that, not like I'm going to bother you and intrude on your personal time, but instead, this is what's required in order to have a happy relationship, which is turning towards spending time together, sharing pleasant experiences. And so the ability to be able to say, not, why are you always bothering me? Why can't you let me be by myself? And instead say, yeah, I'm sorry, that wasn't what I meant. I didn't mean to hurt your feelings. I was just in the middle of doing my thing. And when you asked me, could you, I'd be happy to find some time to spend with you. You know, so it really requires an adjustment on both parts, both to realize how they're asking for time, to be able to have a conversation about the fact that perhaps one of them wants to be closer, spend more time together, have a more in-depth conversation about something that the other person may not have a particular interest in, and the ability to be able to negotiate that is such an important part, because I think the kiss of death in the issues around turning towards with neurodiverse couples is the phrase that, you know, it's not normal that you don't want to spend time with me, or it's not normal that we don't fill in the blank, that we don't spend Christmas with my parents, or whatever the thing is, because being neurodiverse means that just because other people do it is not a good reason. It's not a good enough reason. Right. I don't care if everybody else in the neighborhood does this one thing. I may, as a neurodiverse person, really need to hear why we should do it. Why I should do it if I don't even like it or value it as an activity. So the capacity for the neurotypical to really take on that question seriously and really address the fact that on a personal level, I would like to spend date night with you, and I would like to spend 2 hours having date night with you, and I would like to know 10 different things that you would like to do with me on that date night so that I'm not feeling like I'm dragging you to something that you really don't want to do. That requires a different level of communication than simply
being able to get on your high horse and say, that's not right. You never want to spend any time with me, et cetera.
Oh, my gosh. Nuggets of gold. And I think that this is going to be so helpful to our listeners, because I hear these complaints over and over again. And before I knew I was in a neurodiverse marriage, I complained about these things too. I think you're talking about so many things. I want to talk a little bit about the burnout piece, because I think that sometimes may be a reason why a neurodivergent partner is saying, I don't want to go to that family event, or I don't want to go out and, you know, socialize with your friends, or I don't want to go and, you know, go to our child's, you know, band concert or whatever. But it's taken personally because it may have happened more than once. Now, sometimes it may be due to burnout or overload or whatever. And sometimes it really is that doing social type things might bring anxiety, or it may just not be important. And so how a partner like approaches that rather than being contemptuous or complaining, which I know are part of the, you know, four horsemen of the apocalypse. How can you kind of guide our listeners, especially the non-autistic and neurotypical listeners, to communicate differently with their partners? And then for the autistic partner to hear it differently. Because I know when we may say we want something different from our partner, it may sound like criticism or contempt, but it may just be reaching out and trying to engage. So can you talk a little bit about that, those different nuances in neurodiverse communication?
What I would say is that part of the challenge is that there's only so much energy to be able to give for that neurodiverse partner. And that, let's say you want to go to a wedding and then you want to go to the after party. Your partner, when they're really connected with it, might say, pick one, because I really am happy to go to either one, but I'm just not going to make it to both. There's a cookout next door. And then afterwards, spontaneously, your neighbors say, hey, let's go to dinner.
Right.
Well, it's not unusual for your neurodiverse partner to say, I really need to have some time by myself now. I've spent that time with my mask on, interacting with the neighbors and tolerating the conversation, which I consider to be completely inane. And now I just need to have some time by myself. So number one, it involves what Gottman calls love maps, right? Really understanding your partner, really understanding what makes them tick, understanding that they have so much to give. And when they have maxed out on that amount to give, they're done.
Right.
And unless you want a meltdown, you're going to be able to acknowledge that that's their limit. You have limits. They may be in different places than that. But that's their limit. And so the ability for you to be able to understand that limit and respect that limit creates all kinds of positive outcomes as a result. But very often, neurotypical people are just not that understanding. They can't well, it was just a 2-hour cookout. I mean, why can't we go out to dinner? We're going to have to eat anyway. You know?
Right.
And they're going to push because they're really not getting the idea that this person has a certain amount of bandwidth for socializing, and that's it. Once they hit that limit, they're done.
Right.
Now, you talk about meltdowns, and I want to talk about that in particular because there's a wonderful organization not too far from me, aane.org. And one of the things that they've talked about in terms of doing the training around neurodiversity and working with neurodiverse couples is this notion of a 1 to 5 scale. And it particularly around meltdowns, that scale can be enormously helpful for couples because It doesn't require a lot of words. It just requires a number. Mm-hmm. And number one means, let's just keep talking about this. I'm fine. Number two means, yeah, I'm really into it and I'm following you and the whole thing. Number three is, I'm starting to get upset. So we need to kind of lower the intensity of the conversation a bit. Number four means, I'm on the verge of a meltdown. We've got to stop. And of course, number five is the meltdown.
Right.
So the capacity for somebody to practice together, saying that scale, and of course, the first time you're starting to use it, you may not recognize the difference between three and four. You might have a meltdown as a result of falling into five. But the idea is to communicate without a lot of words, something simple and quick that communicates a whole lot of information. And that can be used in a variety of contexts. Let's say I'm in a mall and I'm too visually stimulated. And I might say to my partner, I'm now approaching a three. So if we stay here much longer, I'm going to just burn out. I'd like to plan to go in the next 10 minutes or so. So that's a quick way of describing, I am too visually stimulated. I am too physically stimulated. I'm too emotionally stimulated, whatever. That's a really good method of being able to improve communication in a simple way for the couple.
Oh, yeah, I love it. And I've heard folks use different color cards where there's a red and a yellow and a green. And so it becomes a visual in addition to speaking about where they are on the scale. And, you know, I think that that's a really important tool for partners to use. I wish that I had known about that previously, but those folks who are using something like that, they really find that I work with in the support groups that I run, they really find that helpful. And I think one of the things that I hear repeatedly is that, you know, the less I take things personal, the better it is. Because if you're out at a family function or you're out at a mall and you're shopping for Christmas or whatever, and you're on a roll and everything's fun and you're ready for lunch or you're ready for the barbecue, and then your partner says, I am at a five or I am at a four and I'm about to get to a five. If you don't want to experience that meltdown or see your partner go into a meltdown or have some kind of burnout reaction, you have to hear them. And, you know, I'm the first person to raise my hand and say, you know, I was not aware of those things. And it created a lot of challenges. I remember my ex and I, we were driving to visit family and it was a long drive. It was a, you know, 13-hour drive and it was for the holidays, right?
Yeah.
And he literally sat in the back seat with his headphones on and did not say a word for 13 hours.
Yeah.
Now, at the time, I thought that was not exactly the way to handle that. But now I understand that he probably would have had a meltdown or he would have been on the verge of burnout because he didn't want to talk. He had had probably a really difficult week at work. He knew he was out of his comfort zone, his environment that was safe, and he was going to have to spend 5 days in another place with people he loved and cared about, but it was going to change everything for him.
Yep.
And I got mad. And so for our non-autistic and neurotypical partners to understand what can trigger a meltdown or a shutdown or autistic burnout is really important. And we need to listen to our partners, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think the one piece that I say that it really resonates is that both couples think they're the ones who are having to make the major adjustments.
Yes.
You ask them, each person says, well, I'm going to have to change a lot more than he or she's going to have to change. And knowing that you're going to think that, even though your partner thinks the exact same thing, I think helps sometimes. You know, your changes feel like huge adaptations, but so do your partner's changes. they are going to feel like huge adaptations too. And the capacity to both respect those differences and to recognize that you're both trying can sometimes be a really important shift in the relationship, where you feel like, I'm the only one that cares. I'm the only one that's working on this relationship, you know? So the capacity for your husband to be able to talk to you, for example, about how much he was dreading those 5 days, for you to be able to understand how upsetting and disturbing it is for him to leave his home where he's used to everything being just the way he likes it, and to be able to be around people and not be able to figure out how to run away and hide from having to interact with those people, no matter how he feels about them. He might have loved your family, but the idea of not being able to do that and having that conversation, I think most people who are neuroatypical have learned over time never to have that conversation. Keep that stuff to yourself and then just be able to do the turtle in order to cope, that you're on your own kind of thing. So, yeah, I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, Dr. K, that is so important for our listeners to hear. And I'm going to speak to the autistic partner, because I think there are lots of folks out there that are masking or camouflaging to protect the relationship or to not have to deal with conflict. Yeah. And that's not healthy. So can you talk about the ways in which couples can communicate differently so they don't feel like they have to mask to avoid conflict or to stop from being emotionally overloaded or flooded? You know, are there some skills that you can impart that would be helpful? Because I know that that is a challenge, the masking and the camouflaging.
Well, I mean, let's look at the very beginning of the relationship, right? The very beginning of the relationship, very often, in the case where the man is neurodiverse, he's been able to woo. And he's been able to seduce his partner because he kept that mask on.
Yeah.
And she fell in love with him because he had that mask on. And so for many couples, the transition from that dating period where he kept his mask on, and then, of course, he could go home and take it off because he perhaps lived alone or lived with his family but didn't have to interact with them. He'd worked that out. Suddenly becomes a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde situation, where now they're married and now there's without meltdown, he cannot constantly keep his mask on. So I think a lot of men in that situation say to themselves, if I show her my true self, I'm going to get there's going to be hell to pay for it. And so I don't have any other option other than to keep it on as long as I possibly can, and then to tiptoe away and hide when she's not looking, which of course does exactly the opposite for her of what she wants, which is she wants to feel loved. She wants to feel like he wants to be with her, that he wants to connect with her emotionally. And when she's putting her guard down, all of a sudden she says, where is he? I was in a conversation with him and I had to answer the phone. Now, where is he gone?
Right.
He doesn't care about me.
Right.
So much of that involves the ability to be able to say, let me understand myself. Okay. So there's plenty of resources out there where you can really begin to understand both what does it mean to be neuroatypical? What are the demands that are different for you from other people? And also, what does it mean to be neurotypical? I just came across a book about, how to understand earthlings, where it really is outlining the way in which neurotypicals think and how that's very different. So the capacity to both understand yourself as a neurodiverse person, and also to be able to understand the way that neurotypicals think provides a capacity for conversation, where before you're trying to, if you're a fish, you're trying to describe water, right? And since you're living in it, it's really hard to be able to say, what is not water if you've only lived in water. So I think that that's really an important first step, is to be able to say, how are we different? And I think that's how therapists who are actually knowledgeable about neurodiverse couples is really important, because for so many couples, they've done a lot of couples therapy, but they have not done it under the guise of that being neuroatypical. And so as a result, the therapist, for example, might use words like, well, how does that make you feel?
Right.
And not understand that the neurodiverse person may be alexithymic, which right. means I don't know how I feel. What am I supposed to? Oh, well, I'll dream up what's the most likely scenario to feel, right, in right. this particular situation. And when they come off as being fake or phony in doing that, their partner trashes them for not being real. So the way that I describe it, it's like you're arguing with your partner and you're saying, I want you to fly. And here we are. If you really love me, you will fly. And we're on the second story and the window is open. And if you love me, fly. So that person, out of dedication and love, says, okay, I'll fly, goes out the window, smashes down on the grass, a story down, is shaken and bruised. Their partner runs down and stands over them and says, you just didn't try.
Yeah. Wow. You know, that is, again, such a powerful image for both partners. And so in that situation, I think it may be difficult for the autistic partner to be assertive and to speak up. And I think I wish that I had a magic wand and I could give both partners the right words that would be filled with love and compassion and grace. I don't have that magic wand. However, there are some things that they can address, talk about differently, and look at each other through a different lens. I say to folks that I talk to, if your partner was blind and you were watching a sunset and they were with you at the beach, what would you say to them? You certainly wouldn't say, open your eyes, can't you see the sun setting? You'd use words that would be filled, hopefully, with love and compassion and grace to share with them what you were seeing so they could envision it in their own way, right? So how do partners communicate with each other in a way that they can both feel heard, understood, and valued? And I think if you can give a few pointers regarding that, you know, based on what you've learned in your clinical experience, as well as what Gottman's research suggests, I think that would be really helpful. How do we understand from a place of compassion? How do we accept that our partners are different? How do we communicate differently?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing is to understand that just because you're neurotypical doesn't mean that you're superior.
Amen.
And it doesn't mean that you then are going to be the instructor, the educator, to help your partner become more like you.
Yeah.
And that's a very challenging idea, because in general, I find, and I am one, so I'm not picking on my own group, but I find that neurotypical people are very, very judgmental. They're deceptive in many of their social communications. They have a tremendous value on socializing and emotion, and much less dependency on facts, on details, on the capacity to think logically and process information that way. And so the first step really is to recognize that you don't have an up on being in an intimate relationship. You have advantages that the culture values, right?
Yes.
Because we live in a culture that's dominated by neurotypical people, but you're not inherently superior because of those advantages. And in fact, I will say to the couples, thank God that we have neurodiversity, and we have a lot of neurodiversity in the culture, and they've helped us to change the world.
Mm-hmm.
So the very first step, I think, is to be able to recognize what are the advantages in you being in this relationship. That's the very first thing to be able to highlight. Yeah. Why this? Why did you fall in love with this particular person? What's been the advantage that's been a part of this relationship? Because if you don't go there as a clinician, if that person who's neurotypical doesn't walk away saying, I'm really lucky that I got a chance to marry this person, then as a couple therapist, you're kind of doomed. Yeah. Because you're going to walk away with them thinking, I now am a caretaker. Yeah. I now have a burden of this marriage, and I have now got to somehow sacrifice in order to keep this relationship going. So I think it begins as an attitudinal framework, and then from there it has to do with the pragmatic skills that we teach every couple, which is to say what you actually mean. Don't expect people to read your mind. I only expect neurotypicals in a neurodiverse marriage to connect and relate and communicate in the same way I expect them with two neurotypicals to communicate, and to be direct, and to have their deepest thoughts and feelings expressed, and to understand that there may be some transcommunication that has to go on, right? Some understanding about the details that you may not have to express if you had a neurotypical partner. You might have to go into detail in a way that you would not have had to go into otherwise. But that's, not the problem, because the problem is in every relationship, 69% of the things that you're irritated by, right, are never going to go away.
Yes.
They're never going to change. You've got to have some adaptable attitude about those differences. And this is just another one of those adaptive things that you need to adjust to. So I think, again, it's for me anyway, if you don't make that shift that says, this is not a death sentence, this is just an individual who has this way of thinking that's different than the way I think, and part of my job, like any relationship, is to be able to leave room to be able to talk respectfully about why they think the way they think. And I think neurodiverse people are better at articulating why they think the way that they think. Yeah. It's the neurotypical partner that has a real difficulty accepting it. Yeah, I know that's true. That's factual, but that's not the point. Well, it kind of is the point.
Right.
You can argue it's not, but it is the point.
Right.
It's exactly. They gave you five different good reasons. You just didn't like those reasons.
Right. Right. And I think that's a really great way to end this conversation, which has been phenomenal. I think that a lot of our listeners, whether they're the autistic or the non-autistic or neurotypical person, need to hear. And you said something, and I've read a lot of Gottman's books, where he talks about like 69% or whatever the percentage is. You said 69, but let's just say somewhere in the 60s.
It is 69%. It's shocking.
69% of what you're experiencing in your relationship is not going to change.
No, it's not going to go away.
So when you see that, when I saw that in print for the first time, I was like, wow, if I had known that way earlier in my marriage, I think I would have been a different person or a different partner. But for our listeners to hear that, and then to think about individually and as a couple, what they can change so they're always looking for a way to understand rather than condemn and have contempt for their partner. Because when we look to understand why our partner wanted to leave an event early or why our partner didn't want to go, or why our partner is sitting with their, you know, headset on in front of their computer for 6 hours, or they're at the gym for 3 hours, or they're not doing something that we want them to do. It's an opportunity for us to communicate and ask, can you help me understand why, right, you know, when you get home from work, you immediately go to your computer?
Right.
And how do I support you? Go ahead.
And can I negotiate with you a different behavior?
Yes.
Right. And can both of us meet each other halfway, right?
Yes.
In a way that's both of us is going to be happy. And what does it mean to me to be alone at that wedding rather than have you there? And right, why does it matter to me why my in-laws would say what's wrong with him and I have to make up an excuse? Why do I have to make up an excuse exactly? So in other words, it provides the opportunity for the person who is neurotypical to say to themselves, I'm really invested in the way things look, and I'm a lot less invested in my partner's emotional stability or my partner's emotional preferences right now. Why is that? Mm-hmm. Right. And that's the beauty of being in a neurodiverse marriage, is that you ask and that person is going to tell you if they feel safe enough with you, if they trust you enough. They're going to actually tell you. You may not like the answer, right, but whose problem is that?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
It's so, the fact that you were talking about safety, I know that in my marriage at the end, my ex did not feel safe sharing his views, because I would get very emotional and scream and flood him. And that was before we knew we were neurodiverse. And so, you know, I own that. And I can tell you that there's probably hundreds and thousands of other people that are in neurodiverse relationships that do not create safety for their partner. And then on the other side, for the autistic partner, you know, they also have an opportunity to create safety for their partner. So if they're having meltdowns on a daily basis, or they're having burnout on a regular basis and not understanding what triggers that and not having the opportunity
to
not be so dysregulated and to be able to communicate to their partner what they need so they can stay more regulated, that's a responsibility as a partner in that relationship too. So it definitely goes to both partners to do their own individual work. There's so many great, you know, nuggets of gold that you provided during the podcast about ways in which both the individuals and the couple can look at different strategies. And so I just want to end by asking you to share if there's one thing that you've learned that you feel kind of you take into most of the therapeutic sessions with the neurodiverse couples that we haven't talked about yet. Is there one thing that you'd like to share with our listeners that is your own little nugget of gold or even platinum?
I think there's many good reasons to love an Aspie.
Yes.
And I think that the culture is very negative in many, many areas. I wrote an article, 5 Good Reasons to Love an Aspie, on my blog, and I've gotten more hostile responses to that post. So to understand that the two of you are the safest, creating that safety in your relationship can help the culture, I think, really appreciate the fact that diversity is a beautiful thing. It's not something to be critical of. And that difference can enrich your lives. It doesn't have to impoverish it. So that was how I would end.
That's perfect. And so if folks want to reach out to you, I don't know if you're taking clients at this time or not, what is the best way for them to reach you, Dr. K?
CouplesTherapyInc.com. A pretty simple, pretty direct, Couples Therapy Inc. And on the site, we also have a lot of psychoeducation on our blog about neurodiversity, and you can certainly reach me through the contact. So.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us. You have provided so much critical information for all of our listeners. And thank you so much for all the work that you do with the neurodiverse couples. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. And it's so wonderful to talk to you.
You too.
Have a great, great time. Great day. Take care.
Take care.